Well, good morning, everyone. It's so nice to see such a fantastic turnout. I want to thank you all for coming. For those of you that don't know me already, my name is Michelle Decker. I'm privileged to be a member of the Stoker Osler Executive Management Team, along with Mike Halls. Are you in the room here, Mike? There he is back there. And Mike Bowler. All right, he's probably still out there, but together we're tasked with not only the everyday running of Stoker Osler, but also the strategic direction. And I'm fortunate to say that I've had the privilege of working with these gentlemen for a long time. I've been with Stoker Osler now for 19 years. Mike Halls and I have worked together now for 17 years, and Mike Bowler and the three of us have worked together now for 14 altogether. So a nice long history to draw on as we guide the firm. And also like to take this moment to recognize what a fantastic team we have at Stoker Osler. A lot of excellent professionals pursuing education and working hard for your benefit. So Stoker Osler employees, if you're in here, please stand up and be recognized. A lot of them are there at the back. So thank you guys. Well, we want to extend a warm welcome to you and our sincere appreciation to you for being valued clients. The trust and confidence and relationship that we have together, we sincerely appreciate that, and it's been built over the years that we're working together. So thank you very much for that. It's our pleasure to host this event today and have a fantastic speaker in Jack Ablin, and he will help give us some information as we navigate your financial future together. At this time, I want to invite everyone to enjoy the excellent food out there through the buffet lines. It starts at the far end and works toward the room. And there's actually two sides to each table, so there should be four lines out there. Hopefully, we'll be able to get everyone through pretty quickly there. But please enjoy good food, enjoy the company of the fellow clients, and please take the time to get to know some of our employees that you haven't had a chance to meet. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Mike Bowler. I'm one of the executive members Michelle introduced earlier. Very glad to be here. I want to reiterate something she said. We're very grateful for you as our clients. We wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the confidence and the trust that each of you has given us. And we do not take that for granted, and I want to personally thank you for that. I know I have a lot of individual clients here as well, but I really feel like in my role that you are all my clients. So I hope you feel free to come up and introduce yourself after this meeting, or feel free to give me a call on the phone if you don't. But again, thank you for being here. So now to introduce our speaker, Jack Ablin. I have to tell you, to introduce a person with this resume gives a person like myself anxiety. I don't know how to even pronounce some of the degrees that he has or remember all of the things that he's done. And if I do all of that, we would not have time to hear his actual presentation. So I'm going to give you the highlights.
Go ahead.
Chief Investment Officer for BMO Private Bank. With that capacity, he's responsible for all things investment, stock selection, asset allocation, macro investment ideas, macro strategy. He's been in the industry for 30 years and with the bank since 2001, so a long history doing this. He's a CFA, a graduate with honors from Vassar College in New York with degrees in mathematics and computer science, went on from there to get his MBA at Boston University, also with honors, and then after that taught at the same school as a professor in finance. You can see Jack on the screen, TV screen, whatever, however you get your media, or read him in print on the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, Bloomberg, and that's just to name a few. He's also an author of Reading Minds in Markets, Minimizing Risk, Maximizing Returns, and a Volatile Global Marketplace. It was a Wall Street Journal 2009 bestseller. So now, for today's presentation, what to expect under Donald Trump. Jack?
Great. Thanks, Mike. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Certainly appreciate it. I want to really extend thanks to Michelle and Mike Halls and Mike Bowler for their leadership and, of course, the invitation. So what I want to do today is really just offer you some observations. I want to try to create a narrative that helps us put into perspective how we got to where we got. Once we dump that into President Trump's lap. We then figure out, okay, how do we manage all of these potentially conflicting interests and come up with a game plan? And then once we have that game plan, figure out what some of the investment implications of those things are. So, you know, and be fascinated to get your comments and questions, and we have cards on the table. Feel free to do that. Anyway, so to kind of kick things off, to get to put it in perspective, an economy, any economy, is a function of two things: growth of its labor force and growth in productivity. In other words, how fast is the labor force growing, and how much more per hour can that labor force deliver to toward output? Okay, so let's take a look at that. So this is the combination in history of labor force growth plus productivity in years past. And one of the things you'll notice, at least from a secular standpoint, it's in somewhat of a decline. Now, if you just focus on the blue bars for a second, that's demographics, right? That's just the growth of 18 to 65-year-olds in the U.S. And not a surprise, in the 1970s to the 1980s, that's when the baby boomers entered the workforce. They became 18 years old, started to become 18 years old, and we had a huge growth of our labor force, 2.4% per year for that entire decade. And on top of that, a decent, I would say, a productivity about 2%, which has really been our kind of a long-term average. And we had a growth rate, a potential, this is our potential growth rate of our economy, of over 4%, 4.5% or so. Move to the next decade, and we had kind of a lull. But interestingly, as we move into 1990 to 2000, we had a big pickup in productivity. That's because the personal computer was introduced in the 1980s, and by the 1990s, we figure out how to integrate it into our workflow, how we were able to take advantage of it. And meanwhile, the blue bar the labor force continued to, that growth rate continued to decline. Next decade, to 2000 to 2010, we were able to harness the benefits of the internet, which were introduced in the 1990s, and we had massive productivity gains as we were able to point and click and not have to drive and go places and find the best deals and all that, all the stuff that went along with it. By 2010 to now, we're suffering a double whammy. In fact, now with productivity at 1.2 and labor force growth at 0.7, our potential growth rate is about 2%. All right, what does that mean? Well, if we go back to the financial crisis and work our way forward from 2009 on, what's our average growth rate of our economy? 2%. What was the last quarter of 2016's growth rate for the economy? 1.9. Year over year, it was 1.9 also. And so we've been stuck in this slow growth mode, largely because that's really where, you know, that's kind of the combination of these factors, and it's hard to diverge away from this over a long period of time without changing those bars, and we'll talk about that. So meanwhile, the Federal Reserve, not content with this continual slowdown in our overall growth rate, decides, well, let's use monetary policy, let's use debt growth to help, you know, fuel some growth rate near term. In other words, let's take sales that should have occurred next year and bring them back to this year to try to jumpstart growth. And for the most part, it worked, at least over the decades that the Fed has been doing this, started in the early 80s. What I'm showing you here is the 10-year Treasury yield. That's the black line. And against that, The blue line shows the savings rate. And what we find is that as the Fed embarked on this policy, every time the economy got the sniffles, they just lower the borrowing rate, encourage borrowing, and sure enough, that savings rate went down. Or in other words, the borrowing rate went up. And that worked pretty effectively, because most of that borrowing was against people's homes. And that worked very effectively until it didn't work anymore. The housing bubble and the financial crisis. Since that time, remarkably, or I guess not so remarkably, it's human nature, is that the Fed continued to lower that interest rate, and the American households didn't respond. They didn't load up on debt, partially because the capacity to take on debt wasn't there. If the value of your home is lower, you can't simply refinance and expand out. Partially just because they didn't want to go through that story all over again. However, whatever the source, traditional monetary policy was no longer effective. And I should point out, and one of the things I like to say before I get started is, you know, I like to study, and here I am, I have a math degree and a computer science background, and yet most of what I do is observe human nature. Because if you think about economics, economics is a social science, and political science is not a STEM science, it's a social science. And so what we try to do is figure out, based on these inputs, look at it long term, and know that if a pendulum swings too far in one direction, we're going to see some social pushback. And that's kind of what I want to sort of describe to you today, how we end up where we are and what we've essentially dumped on President Trump's agenda and how he's going to respond. All right, so traditional monetary policy not working anymore. So what did the Fed do and other central banks do? They went to Plan B. Quantitative easing. Let's just buy bonds directly, try to stimulate the entire yield curve, and perhaps stimulate growth that way. And for the most part, it did encourage some risk-taking, but the premise behind quantitative easing is simply lower the value of your currency and then export your way to prosperity, right? Let the rest of the world buy your stuff. The problem is everyone did that all at the same time. And so it wasn't that effective. In fact, if you look at global trade as a percentage of world GDP, you can see, you know, it had started on a decline in the early 2000s. And yeah, there was a little bit of a blip up in 2010-11, but in theory, exporting your way to prosperity wasn't really one of the key, you know, especially as all your trading partners are trying to do the same thing, a way to get that working. So that's sort of where we are. What it did end up doing, though, creating a very cheap financing and a central bank that was very supportive, it did encourage risk-taking. Because when overnight interest rates, when savings accounts, when risk-averse saving was losing ground relative to inflation, that lit a fire under everybody to say, you got to move out on the risk curve, take some more chances, because left alone, the value of your savings is going to erode relative to inflation if you just leave it in a CD or something like that. Meanwhile, we are seeing some improvement in capital expenditure plans, and one of the key things in expanding productivity is expanding productivity is capital investment. So we need capital investment to increase. If businesses are investing in their business, if they're expanding research and development, will ultimately, maybe not right away, but ultimately lead to higher productivity. But instead, what companies are doing, it created this quantitative easing, created an unintended consequence. And that is issue debt in other countries, bring that money back here, and then buy back your shares. So, for example, if you look at a McDonald's bond, just tell them I'm busy right now. McDonald's bonds the third quarter of last year, issued a bond in the U.S., 10-year McDonald's bond, issued a bond in the U.S. at 2.8% for 10 years. That same company issued a bond, I'm sorry, it was in fourth quarter of 2015, issued a bond in the U.S. at 2.8%. McDonald's subsequently issued a bond in Europe at 0.8%. Same credit, same company, same maturity, all other things being equal. Why could they get away with a 0.8% rate in Europe? Is because the European rates were so much lower than the U.S. rates. And how can those two peacefully coexist if you believe that the euro, the only difference between those two bonds was McDonald's issued that 10-year bond in euros and the domestic bond in dollars. But what they simply did was issued it at 0.8, brought the money back home, translated it to dollars, and bought back their shares. And that helped stimulate the stock market, but we didn't see an expansion in McDonald's. We didn't see an expansion in burger flipping machines. We haven't seen new menu items. We haven't seen research and development. It's just simply there are fewer shares outstanding for McDonald's. So we do need to get, if we're going to see productivity expand, we're going to need to see capital expenditures expand. And that's right now the Fed, what I'll call unintended consequences of the central banks. All right, so let's move on then to job growth. How do we get more jobs? Well, what we find is if you look at the breakdown of the workforce by company size, you'll find that 78% of Americans work for companies of 500 employees and fewer. And that's where job growth comes from. Job growth comes from startups. Job growth comes from small companies as they expand. It does not come from companies of 1,000 or more. Companies of 1,000 or more are trying to do the same amount of business with fewer people. That's what productivity means to them. But job growth comes from startups. The problem is startups have been in secular decline over the last 30 years or so. What we see is that the rate of startup formations of new businesses is half of what it was in the late 1970s and early 80s. And the share of U.S. workers at firms that are less than 1 year older is down by almost two-thirds. And so why is it that there's so few startups? Partially because companies over the last 30 years arguably have gotten too big. So Jason Furman, who is chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama, did a study that I found fascinating, and he looked at 900 different industries, and he looked at the top four companies in these industries and found that 30 years ago, the top four companies controlled about a quarter of the market share of the industry they were in. Fast forward to 2015, those companies controlled between a third and a half of their industry market share. Why is that important? Because when companies get too big, and I would argue, and probably Furman would argue too, is that as companies got big, they bought influence in Washington, and had Washington help them build legislative moats that prevent startups from competing against them. And I remember in probably the mid-80s, late 80s, I was not a big fan of Microsoft, and I'm still not a big fan of Microsoft. And the reason why is because it was a company, in my opinion, that got too big. They got fat, dumb, and happy, and their products they never had the incentive to innovate because nobody was ever competing against them. And I remember making the comment that said if we built cars the way Microsoft built operating systems, we'd be abandoning them in the streets. Thankfully, and it wasn't Congress's help, but thankfully Apple and Google came along and finally started to challenge Microsoft. And of course, atrophy set in, and now they're, you know, kind of a distant third or fourth, for that matter. So if companies get too big and they're not innovating, that means, what does that mean to us? It means that they're not going to innovate. They're not, the productivity is going to stay low. They're going to keep cashing their check, but keep innovation, because you know, that costs money at a minimum. And that's why we're seeing startups kind of slower. All right, so let's take a look. So that's what I'll call draining the swamp type of thing. We need to figure out, break that influence that some of these companies have in the Senate and Congress. So on the constituent side, the headline should read, "Anger is the New Hope." And this is the real income growth by quintile of Americans over the last roughly 15 years or so. And what we find is that the lower off you start, the worse things got. That incomes relative to inflation trailed for probably, like I said, probably since 2000. Now, if your income is trailing inflation, but inflation is at 4%, then this relationship is pretty insidious, right? Because you're going to get 2 or 3% wage increases, you're going to keep your job, and you're going to feel like you're moving forward, and you don't realize that you're on a down escalator that happens to move faster than how the pace at which you're walking up the steps. And I would say for the 2000s into 2010 or so, that was the state of affairs, that we had an inflation rate high enough where people were incomes were trailing inflation, but everyone had jobs and everyone was getting raises. But since 2009 or so, since this recovery, inflation has been effectively zero. Now, what happens in an environment where incomes trail inflation and inflation is zero? It means now no longer are people staying in their jobs and getting increases that are less than the inflation rate. They're actually losing their jobs and having to find other jobs at a lower pay. And now, so psychologically, now that slap in the face, or it isn't quite a tickle anymore, it's a slap in the face, is probably what I should, the way I would describe it. So that's step one. So as inflation got to zero, it became apparent that this condition exists. What I find most startling is that 69% of Americans have less than $1,000 saved in the bank. What that means is these are people, if they're working, are working paycheck to paycheck. These are people who use Social Security as their pension. They use Obamacare or Medicaid or other sources as their primary health care. And they feel like they're one slip and fall away from bankruptcy. And so these are people who rely on the government to continue to provide them with entitlements or benefits to keep their lifestyle together. And they feel that Washington doesn't have their back, that Washington is more focused on dismantling these pieces than they are in building them up. And that's why I found remarkable, this was the first presidential campaign in my recollection where both candidates were on the same side of the entitlement story. They wanted to actually reinforce entitlements and not have, you know, one that tried to streamline and reduce them and another one would try to expand it. So that's, you know, so there's a sense of vulnerability and a reliance on Washington, and they feel this contract is eroding. The next I find pretty remarkable, and this is really goes to this sort of wealth and savings effect, and I think what we find here, and let me kind of take you through this, household income since 1980 has expanded by 200%. Inflation has expanded by 175%. The price of a boat, 187%. And yet, The S&P 500 over that period has expanded by 3,600%. What that means is, for those of you who are looking at this, if you have a choice of spending money or saving it and giving it to Stoker Osler and invest it for you, first of all, there's a huge tailwind behind that decision. But the other point is, let's say you decided in 1980 you wanted to buy a $100,000 boat, but instead of taking that $100,000, you put it in the S&P 500, and then you wanted to buy that same $100,000 boat that was now $175,000, you'd find that in S&P terms, that boat is $17,000, not $100,000. Okay, that's the point. So my point here is, if you've got less than $1,000 in the bank, chances are you don't have an S&P 500 portfolio. And so the wealth now in the country has really diverged. And what's behind all this? And this is really, I'm going to say, the crux of this tension is this pendulum that keeps swinging back and forth, creating pushback. And what this pendulum depicts here is corporate profits divided by employee compensation. And so when we start at the low point here in the late 1970s and early 80s, employee compensation as a percentage of GDP was at an all-time high, and corporate profits as a percentage of GDP was at an all-time low. So let's think about what was going on in this country in the mid to late 1970s. One, how many people would have wanted to buy an American car in the mid to late 1970s? They weren't great, right? They were, in my mind, they lasted just past the warranty date, and then they fell up. They kind of timed it so that the warranty would run out, and then all the wheels would fall off. Union membership was widespread. And what we found was that our economy didn't have the agility or flexibility to respond to stress. And one huge stress that we endured as a nation in 1973 was the OPEC's oil embargo, if you remember that. And normally, in a healthy, functioning economy, an oil shock, a supply shock to that degree would certainly be a body blow. It would create a kind of a sap demand, create a recession, and then we would bounce back once prices came down, or we figured other ways to do things. In this case, what happened was because these union contracts had CPI escalators built into their wages, this oil shock metastasized into wages, creating double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation, a stock market that was terrible, and we blamed a weak peanut farmer from Georgia, and we got rid of him, and brought Reagan in, and Britain at the same time brought Thatcher in, and embarked on what we'd call strong policies. What were these strong policies? They were deregulation, break up the unions, right, the PATCO strike. It was globalization. It was a focus on becoming efficient. And lo and behold, it worked. And sure enough, that pendulum of profits to wages started to move in the other direction. So let's take a look at globalization, because between 1988 and 2008, this is a 20-year period, globalization worked. It did what it was supposed to do. That it took 2 billion people from abject poverty and brought them up to the middle class. The problem was it came at a cost, and that cost was the well-being of blue-collar wage earners in the developed world. So what I'm showing you here, it looks like an elephant, but what I'm showing you here is percentile of global income from the poorest part of the world to the richest part of the world, and real income growth over this 20-year period, the go-go years of globalization. And what you see is that if you're in the poorest, the you know, completely out of it, then nothing happened to you. But as you start moving into the emerging world, China, India, other places, you had a huge boost of wealth, or at least your income relative to inflation, which meant that your standard of living improved dramatically. This 75 to 80 period, that's the working class in UK, in Europe, and in US and other places. And then, of course, the global elite. These are the shareholders that enjoyed the profits from this endeavor, benefited immensely at the same time. So what were some of the consequences? One, that we lost 8.3 million manufacturing jobs between that over this pendulum swing between the late 1970s and the financial crisis. We've gotten roughly a million of those jobs back. So now we're at about 7.4 or so million jobs. A lot of the jobs here in this country require now a college degree, as we've shifted from a manufacturing economy to a service-oriented economy. And you can see that even with the financial crisis, that the number of employed Americans with a college diploma flatlined, but it didn't really drop that much. But you'll notice that over 20 years, that the number of those employed with a high school diploma has essentially flatlined as we've moved to jobs that now require more skills. And why is that? What I would argue is, and what studies show, is that of the, say, 7 million jobs that we've lost in manufacturing over that time frame, that only 1 million of those jobs was attributable to globalization and outsourcing, even though President Trump has vowed to get these jobs back. But only about 1 million of those jobs, 6 million of those jobs were lost to innovation, technology, robotics, other things. Let's take a look. Well, if we notice that if you look at sort of what I'll call the new companies versus the old companies, that the evolution of productivity, innovation, and so forth, it really creates two things. One is it makes the value of skills erode over time, right? So if I'm trained as an elevator operator, if I'm a receptionist, if I'm working in a factory and the company, the environment around me evolves and innovates, then unless I retrain or ramp up my skills, the value of what I'm contributing erodes. I'd like to make the point that, you know, and think about how quickly that is. I mean, it wasn't long ago I could stand up here with a BlackBerry and it would be a status symbol. Now you'd laugh at me if I had one of those. And the other side of it is that the value of ideas accelerates. What that means is that fewer and fewer people can create more and more value. So what I'm showing you here is that market cap divided by employees of new companies versus old companies. And I think it was 2012 when Facebook came public. It was valued as a $35 billion business. And at that time, General Motors was a $35 billion business. The difference was that General Motors had over 300,000 employees and Facebook had 2,000 employees. 2014, Facebook bought a company called WhatsApp. They paid $19 billion for WhatsApp. WhatsApp had 55 employees. So if you consider now the value of ideas and how you're able to leverage an idea versus focus on skills, that's creating certainly challenges, but also opportunities. For investors, we're looking at opportunities. Now, why is that? Largely because of the connectivity of innovation to customers. You know, it took 75 years for the telephone to reach 50 million customers, and about half that for the radio, and about half that still for the television. By a couple years ago, it took 35 days for Angry Birds to get 50 million customers. So be able to take an idea and leverage it is enormous. But that's not what people, we're not, you know, we're not a nation necessarily of ideas. We're a nation of workers and some ideas and so forth. So we have to address that balance. And so when it comes down to this balance, this trade-off between wages and profits, we've got this pie slice challenge. And this is what President Trump faces. He has to create an environment in which we're growing faster, but we're allocating these pie slices somewhere between. These are two extremes, right? 1982 was one extreme, where nearly 90% of output was benefited compensation, to another extreme where, you know, about 80%. So let's say he tries to get middle ground. We have to now shift more toward, you know, probably a 85-15 or somewhere in there. But the fact is, this pie has to shift, and it has to shift in favor of wages. I mean, that's what President Trump's constituency put him in office to do. How is he going to do it? Well, one is, he says, we got to grow at 4%. Why is that? Well, because if we're growing the pie big enough or fast enough, then we can rearrange the slices without creating pushback, right? We need to grow it, and then we can maybe have some latitude to rearrange the slices. And I think that's really the mission. Create a business friendly environment, create the incentives, focus on U.S. and workers and get people employed. But at the end of the day, this pie slice is going to be somewhere between these two. It's not going to be what we've enjoyed since 2011. So let's take a look at how do you deliver, in the context of what I've presented to you, how do you deliver 4% growth? And what are the implications of 4% growth? You know, you essentially have this 2% donkey, and we're going to try to beat it into a 4% racehorse. And we can do it over short periods of time, but there are some implications. One is, if you go back to our model, we can increase the labor. How do you increase the labor force quickly? Immigration. Well, I put it out there. It's out of the question, right? We're not increasing immigration under this plan. And quite honestly, immigration may not necessarily help those constituents that voted for President Trump in the first place. Improve productivity growth. Sure, how? Well, part of it is by leveling the tax rate, where our corporate tax rate in this country right now is the highest in the world. Make it fairer relative to the other parts of the world. We can get that $2 trillion or so of stranded cash in other countries back here. And companies tend to invest where their cash is, and they tend to hire where their cash is. And so that could be one way that we can spur some growth. Another, government-funded, right? Well, we've got a $1 trillion infrastructure program. We want tax cuts. That's going to cost about $12 trillion over 10 years. If you adjust for the incremental growth, that comes down to $10 trillion. I don't know if that's going to pass muster in the Senate. We'll see. One outcome is inflation, right? If you're going to take something that has a capacity to grow at 2 and force it to grow at 4, one likely outcome is some inflation. And we're starting to see inflation pressure build. And then a margin compression, right? If we're going to take some of this growth and divert it, if you will, to wages, then that's going to create some profit margin compression. So let's take a look at, you know, where the various asset classes have come from since the election. You can see small caps, certainly, largely because U.S. small caps, obviously domestic focus, they tend to pay the highest corporate tax rates anyway. The largest multinationals tend to, you know, were able to exploit globalization and the global trade policies and situate their businesses all over the world and pay incrementally lower taxes. Crude oil, thanks to a re-encouragement of domestic production and other incentives, a rollback on some regulations, Master Limited Partnerships for the same reasons. U.S., Buyback Achievers, these are companies that have been buying back their shares, have also benefited. And then bonds, gold, and pretty different varieties of bonds as interest rates have gone up. So probably not a huge surprise here. Within the S&P 500, financials, one of the biggest winners. Why? Because really two things. One, with a higher interest rate environment, banks and other financial institutions have a wider margin to make profits between borrowing and lending, but also the regulatory rollback. In fact, I will tell you, our relationship with the regulators even now seems to have calmed down, and they seem to be willing to be a little more reasonable and I don't want to say offer concessions, but certainly have dialed down the rhetoric, so to speak. You have to keep in mind that a company like ours has over 1,000 people just dedicated to compliance. We've got 350 people dedicated to anti-money laundering. These are people that don't carry business cards. They're not looking to generate new business for us. They come in and work, and we pay them, and they go home. But that's the cost of complying with the Patriot Act and some of the other things that we have to do. Nearly half of our technology spend is diverted to compliance. So these are dollars that we can't spend on making, your mobile phone interface easier and other things like that. So, and that's not just at BMO, that's at other banks worldwide. So anyway, so you see those benefits there and so forth. So let me just take you through how we see things. There are five main factors that we look at when we evaluate the S&P 500. And what we find is that four of them are actually pretty bullish. The underpinnings of the economy, the availability of funds, liquidity, psychology is actually not bad. We don't have these crazy-eyed investors looking that the market's going to go to the moon. They are pretty cautious. Momentum is pretty strong. The one holdout is valuation. The price that we have to pay for what we get seems pretty high. So I would say that I'm not, the nice thing about this picture is this isn't a picture of a crash. Okay, this is a picture of maybe a correction, but a correction that creates an opportunity, not a correction that would be some message, some omen to run for the hills. Because one of the things that I find fascinating is while this recovery, we're in the eighth year, this is the longest recovery that we've enjoyed in post-World War II history, it's also been the slowest. And you know what? In many respects, it's a good thing because it's not built on debt. It's not built on excess. It's not built on huge expectations. In fact, as I showed you, that households are, whether they choose to or not, or the forced to, are much more prudent with their situation. And I think I would call what this recovery is more of a hiking boot recovery than a running shoe recovery. And I could see a recovery going much even further than 8 years because of the trajectory of which it's on. Earnings, however, are expected to grow pretty dramatically. In fact, by Q4 2017, analysts are expecting 13.5% earnings growth on 6% or so sales growth for this year. So that's a big number. And so that is predicated on a lot of the plans that President Trump and other leaders have articulated actually coming online. And it remains to be seen. If you look at this, I find this is a fascinating study that we've done. What we find is that the S&P 500, so this is the black line, is fueled by only two things. If you're investing in the market, You only get two things. You get profits and you get dividends. That's it. There's no psychic value for owning a great company, right? Or there is, but it's not worth anything. You may feel good about it, but when you buy stock, all you're signing up for are earnings and dividends. Simple. So what we did was we went back and we said, all right, let's look at the relationship, the growth in the stock market relative to the growth in earnings and dividends, and see if that's actually true. And for the most part, it is. We had, you know, certainly had a tech bubble where the market grew far away in excess of earnings and dividends, came back, and then since that time has expanded. And what we find is since 2013, that the S&P is up 60% and earnings and dividends are up 30%. Okay, well, before you walk away thinking we need a 30% correction, we have to keep in mind that the S&P 500 and investors are always forward-looking. So what I did was we took this 13.5, which is baked in for 2017, and plugged it on top of where we are, and that gets us to about 401. So if we achieve everything we want in earnings that analysts are expecting, plus we get the dividend that's set to pay out, that would get us to about 401 versus 430, which suggests that the S&P is about 10% overdone relative to these and that's assuming that companies can deliver on those expectations. So let's assume they do. All right, so now we're just looking for a 10% correction, but for longer-term investors like yourselves, we're not here to quibble over 10% over a three-quarter period. We'd say, fine, it's worth looking past the valley, knowing that we've got still a very solid fundamental picture in which to invest over the next several years. And the fact is, I wouldn't recommend anyone owning a share of stock unless you had a 7 to 10 year time horizon. I mean, it's just too unpredictable over shorter periods of time. Now, there is one metric that allows us to say stocks are cheap, and that's bonds. So if you go back and look at earnings yield, which is simply the reciprocal of the P/E ratio, earnings divided by price rather than price over earnings, and compare that to the BBB bond yield, which is roughly a good proxy for companies' funding rates in the S&P, you'll see, you know, from 2002 to 2009, that they move pretty much in tandem. It was a good metric for gauging fair value in stocks. And thanks again to the Federal Reserve's monetary policy plus their extraordinary measures, that BBB bond yield came down pretty dramatically. And while the earnings yield came down too, we still have about a 1.4% advantage of owning the S&P 500 than owning BBB bonds. On the economic front, the market does tend to track economic surprises. And the good news is the economy here and abroad are surprising economists' expectations to the upside. So that's good. So let me kind of finish up here just put some policy implications on. One is, let's assume that interest rates do have to go higher. And if we go back and look at the last year, every week we sort of just captured the average return, the average weekly return when the 10-year Treasury moved up by five basis points or 0.05% in a week, what the results were. And, you know, master limited partnerships, S&P 500 dividend, even dividend equities did okay. And so certainly it favors stocks over bond-like and REITs and gold. If the dollar were to weaken, which the dollar is relatively expensive to our trading partners, and of course we're trying to create a more export-oriented economy. President Trump has been an outspoken fan of a weaker dollar. The Federal Reserve has too. If we do actually get a weaker dollar, you can see this is for a 0.5% move, then the foreign markets will actually do better than the U.S. In fact, emerging markets year-to-date are doing much better than the S&P 500, a lot of the domestic And that's largely because they're trading, international markets are trading at a 20 to 30% discount to the U.S. So certainly worth having exposure to the international sector in your portfolio. And that we expect could actually provide a nice little boost for performance this year. And then lastly, the border adjustment tax. I know you probably heard about it. I've been watching it. And this is Congress's way for President to allow for President Trump's tax cuts to go in if they are accompanied by a border adjustment tax. And that essentially a border adjustment tax credits exports and taxes imports. It's like a consumption tax. And what it does is, because we're an import-oriented country, a border adjustment tax would raise about $1 trillion or so over a decade, which is great, and it could help offset some of the costs of lowering personal income taxes and corporate taxes and the like. The problem is, if you consider that Washington is a sausage factory, putting a border adjustment tax in place would require a lot of grinding and stuffing, because it isn't just simply evenly spread on all these industries. In fact, it's argued that Walmart, which makes its whole living on importing stuff and selling it to people, would actually have to pay $10 billion a year more in taxes under a border tax adjustment arrangement. So I would have to imagine they've got lobbyists knocking on their representative's door. And you can sort of see that, you know, aircraft, a Boeing, aerospace industry, leasing, finance would benefit, motion pictures would benefit, and of course, textiles, apparel, remarkably, even, you know, the iPhone, I mean, a lot of those components are imported, electronic equipment, furniture, autos, would be incrementally negative for those groups. So it's something we're watching. Right now, it wavers between impossible and slim, but it is something out there. And my concern is, if the border adjustment tax passes, then we're going to have to revisit everything. If the border adjustment tax doesn't pass, then the likelihood of getting these other tax cuts through comes down. Now, maybe we can focus on corporate and leave personal alone, I don't know. But we have to reevaluate that. So my bottom line is, I still think that in spite of the fact that the market is somewhat stretched on a valuation basis, the fundamental underpinnings of what we're doing, I think, are sound. I think that the direction, the general philosophy is correct. I do believe Washington has, in some cases, ignored business and business growth. In other cases, they've favored them 2 months. I think we do need a balance. And so for our preference, I think that tends to favor the smaller and mid-sized companies that do business here. And a company like GE, you know, has optimized its business on measures that have been put in place over the last 30 years. Now that we're making a 180-degree turn, what does that mean for a company like that? I think they'll do okay, but it definitely... there's a question mark there on how that plays out. So those are, and then invest in ideas. I mean, I would much rather invest in ideas than skills, and there are a lot of great ideas out there. So with that, let me stop there and open it up for whatever questions are out there.
As Michelle mentioned earlier, the way we're going to do the questions today, if you've had a chance to think of one, if you'll hold that up, we'll have one of our staff members grab that from you. And we've got a few over here.
Answer to the first question is the Chicago Cubs.
What's the answer?
Who's going to win the World Series again? 2 years in a row.
So I believe we're going to have Evan and Sean look through these questions quickly, make sure that we eliminate those that may be duplicative. But And then we'll have Evan ask these questions, Jack, okay?
Sure.
All right, Jack, first question for you. What will happen to our workforce with increased use of robots?
It's a great question, and it's one that we have no policies right now to address. Certainly President Trump has not really acknowledged the trends in technology and innovation as a pressure on jobs. I mean, just think of the automatic self-driving vehicles. If we start having self-driving cars and trucks, has the potential of eliminating 3.5 million jobs. I don't have a clear answer. We don't want to be Luddites and throw wooden shoes into the machinery, but we do need to somehow redistribute from the capital that and wealth that's created, profits that created from innovation, and toward those Americans who are displaced. Bill Gates suggested a robot tax. You know, there may be other things out there, but I do think that policymakers and business leaders have to really consider the implications of technology, not to staunch technology, but to prepare for those outcomes.
Great, thank you. Next question, what is the long-term investment outlook for brick-and-mortar retail stores?
Well, you'll still need to get a haircut, probably. That's probably not a fair question. My daughter works for Amazon, so that's probably not a great question. I think that, you know, there's still some opportunity, but you can see that, in fact, I've got slides that'll show you department store sales this year, or I should say in the full year 2016, were lower than they were in 2000. Were lower. Even with the economy expanding the way it has, they are lower. I think that it's just the trend. It's just going to continue to erode brick and mortar, which means then that has implications for malls and real estate and other things. What I find is that once these stores or once these online retailers know your perfect size, okay, have you perfectly measured out, you could get point and click and get custom clothes delivered to you, and they would be made. The good news is they would be made locally, so those are favorable trends. But you would see more brick and mortar manufacturing here at home, but the retail I think would continue to put downward pressure on retail.
Okay. Question about the border adjustment tax. How many other developed world economies have a border adjustment tax, and what type of tax rate is typical?
Sure. Well, most countries that we engage with don't have a border adjustment tax. They have a value-added tax, which is very similar. If you go to Europe, and if you remember, let's say you buy an item in Europe, what happens? If you just buy it and don't say anything, you're going to have to pay a value-added tax. If you buy it and keep the receipt and they know it's getting exported, you get that tax back, right? That's the same thing that a border adjustment tax would be. But it's instead a border BAT would be administered at the corporate level. VAT is administered at the consumer level. But they're both consumption taxes.
How does healthcare fit into our economic future?
Healthcare is a vitally important piece of our economic future. I've given you presentations in the past where it looks like that mountain that we're going to fly into. We have to address it. We spend twice as much per person on healthcare as any other nation, and we have lesser results. So I think that while I'm not saying Obamacare is a great solution, it is one step toward a central payer system. I think that's ultimately where we have to go, that we have to decide what the inalienable right for healthcare is, and kind of draw a border around it and call it basic cable. And then if you want something in addition to that, then you go into the private market for insurance. But there are a couple of issues with healthcare. I think one of them, probably the hardest one, and one of the other reasons why business startups are difficult is because a lot of budding entrepreneurs' healthcare is provided by their employer. And so one additional risk that a potential entrepreneur faces, in addition to the financial risk and the business risk of starting a business, is the potential of losing their healthcare benefit once they quit their 9-to-5 job at a large company. And so by moving it away, at least basic coverage, moving it away from the employer-employee relationship, perhaps we could encourage more business startups, which we need.
This next question is a two-part question. Part one, will Trump's administration encourage R&D innovation to increase new product development? And part two, how will military spending affect the marketplace?
Yeah, I think that's one good thing about having business leaders in these policymaking positions. They understand the relationship between policies and profits and policies and corporate incentives. So I think that by leveling the playing field in terms of taxes, doing business in this country versus doing business in other countries, I think that will help innovation here at home, hiring, and some expansion. You know, keep in mind that that Ireland and Hong Kong have the lowest corporate tax rates in the world, and not a surprise that foreign direct investment as a percentage of GDP in Ireland and Hong Kong are among the highest in the world. They're going to invest where they're treated the best. And so so trying to level those playing fields will help. Defense, I do think that, spending, you know, it isn't simply building a bomb and blowing it up. I mean, I think that there are other innovations in developing defense industry and technology, and we've had a lot of benefits from that, GPS and some other things that we enjoy in our cars. So I think it's a positive, but, you know, we have to, you know, obviously make sure we have a budget to keep it all together, because we don't want to just keep writing checks without any way of knowing that we can recoup some of those expenditures.
Great, thank you. Next question. How much has the financial and energy sectors recently affected market valuations? As an example, low earnings for the energy making the market PE seem high.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of it is. I mean, part of the reason why we're seeing strong earnings growth this year was because last year energy prices were low, and so the energy sector has moved up. But that doesn't explain why you would see 13.7% earnings growth for next year, at least from the energy sector. Perhaps some of it is the financial sector. If interest rates rise and that net interest margin widens, that helps. If we roll back regulation, that helps. Could incrementally help energy companies as well. So I think certainly energy has a big part of it. I think financials have a big part of it. But we also have to pay for some of this stuff too. You know that, you know, healthcare, for example, is one of the best performing sectors this year, and yet we know that President Trump's going to take a pound of flesh out of that industry. So we have to figure out, you know, why is it that sector's doing as well as it is.
Okay. This next question is asking about the concept you mentioned of investing in ideas. The question is anyone looking into investments in companies looking to solve big world problems like power, food, clean air for a better world for future generations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's our job. You know, we're doing that. That's part of the analysis. We have a whole stock selection process in which those kinds of things are taken. Long-term growth prospects and the ability to expand and market expansion is a critical element there. And so, you know, if you're looking at, you know, and I'm not saying we're going to give up on coal, but the fact is that, you know, we would rather find an investment either in a country or a company or a sector where there's a long runway of opportunity rather than something that's sort of a quick pop, like, you know, like the coal, you know, hey, coal did great, but we're not going to play in these, you know, one quarter or two quarter moves. That's not really what our strategy is.
Great, thank you. We had several questions about the impact of lower corporate tax rates and how that will affect repatriating and bringing money back into the U.S.
Yeah, I think anything's going to help. I mean, I will say there may be a honeymoon period where we've got this $2 trillion stranded, so we could maybe offer some kind of a honeymoon period. You bring this money back. I've heard in the corporate tax plan a way to expense capital expenditures in year one. So perhaps that's a way to encourage some of the investment that we're looking at. If you're looking at, you know, if you look at plant, property, equipment, the age, it's very old. Now some of it can be, you know, can continue to sustain itself, you know, we found similar measures a couple of years ago in cars. They were, I think, average auto on the road a few years ago was 11 years. You know, which suggests that, you know, there, you know, for every 5-year-old car, there's a 20 some odd year old car. So, resolved itself, right? We sold 17.5 million cars last year. So, as the plant, property, equipment gets old, it will be needing to be replaced, and I'm hopeful that'll happen. I'm actually encouraged it will.
Great. A couple of questions about U.S. debt level, entitlement spending. Where do we go with continued year after year deficit spending due to entitlements?
Well, that's, I think, one of the things that we find remarkably absent in the, you know, in the debate in Washington this year, that partially because the U.S. dollar is a fiat currency, partially because the Federal Reserve was able to purchase $4.5 trillion of Treasury debt, and partially because, you know, we have a president that's not shy about using debt in his history. So I'm not sure where that goes. I can tell you that while we're certainly wringing our hands over debt to GDP of, you know, 90% or so, we have to also know that Japan has a debt to GDP of 230%. And, you know, when the markets get nervous, the yen actually rises. So I'm not sure what the right answer is. Obviously, we've got Senate Republicans that are very concerned, as they should be, but it's a very difficult situation. But the good news, I suppose, and maybe this is what's going through President Trump's mind, is as long as we control the keys to the printing press, we're never going to default on our debt. It's just the value of the currency in which it's denominated and just keeps dropping. So I don't know what the right answer is there. We probably can sustain more debt, but we don't want to, you know, we want to be able to have a path in which we can at least see a plan for it to come down. And right now, that's not out there.
Okay. This next question is about the Federal Reserve. The Fed seems to be under attack. What changes do you anticipate over the next 4 years?
Oh, did you read my piece that I wrote this morning? I wrote a piece this morning that said how robots are taking over more and more jobs. And I said, it's high time that we replace Janet Yellen with an algorithm. And then I got a lot of feedback that said, did you know that it's International Women's Day? Did you need to beat up on Janet Yellen on International Women's Day? So I had to email a few sorries around. But no, I think that, you know, my point was that I don't want to replace Janet Yellen with a machine, but I wanted to show that monetary policy is too easy. It's our interest rates are just too low. If you look at the Taylor rule, which is the mechanism in which we could put in and then have a completely transparent policy without any uncertainty, which is certainly one of the criticisms of the Fed. The Taylor rule right now says the overnight interest rate should be 3.8, not 0.7. So I'm not going to quibble whether the Taylor rule is exactly right. All I'm saying is that overnight rates are too low based on the parameters that we have in place. And I think we're running a risk of inflation. And so we have to be, and we're creating a froth in the equity markets and risk-taking that, you know, may seem healthy right now, but could certainly get out of hand if we let it continue. So, that's my response there. Now I know I didn't answer your question, so what was the original question?
I don't remember. what changes to the Federal Reserve do you anticipate?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have some open positions. I don't know if they would come under greater scrutiny. I know Rand Paul and others would like to see the Federal Reserve reporting to Congress. I think it's probably a smart thing having them independent. President Trump will, I think Janet Yellen's term is up in early 2018, and President Trump's going to appoint somebody. But I also think that he will probably appoint someone that has a pretty solid business and financial background. And I think one of the things that we realize is you need someone that has a Rolodex. You need somebody that can call, know these key Wall Street people, know these key banking people, and make outgoing phone calls. And that's something that Janet Yellen doesn't have. She didn't have a relationship with these people, and I'm not sure Bernanke really knew. But thankfully, Hank Paulson did. And so, when things stress out, you have to be in touch with people. You have to understand what's going on, what the balance sheet's looking like, what your overnight book looks like. And you have to have a background in it and know these people. Coming from academia is great, but if you're going to just do academics, then I would go with the Taylor rule.
Okay, one last question.
Good. I was going to say, usually I say I have time for one question, but go ahead. Yeah.
What were you tweeting at 6:30 this morning?
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I think just to the fact that you all are here and you're is really a tribute to the work that these guys do. We're very proud of them, and I'm hopeful you are too. We're delighted to have you as clients, and I'll turn it back over to Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Let's give Jack another hand. So we know that there were many good questions that weren't asked. If your question didn't get asked, Jack will be here for several minutes after. You're welcome to come forward and speak with him and ask questions. And just to let you know, we will post the audio to his presentation on the website, as well as distribute a copy of these slides to each of you that were here today. So if that was a question. We just wanted to once again give thanks to Jack. He's a very busy man. And we're appreciative of him taking his time out of his busy schedule to come be with us here today. So thank you, Jack. And for his continued support of Stoker Osler over these past number of years. He's spoken to a group of our clients in Salt Lake City a number of times, and he's very well-liked and in demand, and we appreciate that. We want to recognize the Stoker Osler staff that's here. If you'll take a look around, we have a wonderful staff. They're amazing. Those of you who deal with them on a day-to-day basis know they're fantastic, and they worked hard to make this a good event, as well as they work very hard to try and make your lives easier on a day-to-day basis. So we want to express appreciation to them. And lastly, we just want to say thanks to you. Thank you for these many great years that we've worked with many of you. As Michelle mentioned, she and I have worked together for 17 years. Back to the days when we were in a little cube and our chairs bumped into each other when we backed out, and I drove her crazy because she likes dead quiet to work and I like a little white noise or a whistle. And so it's been a long time, but it's been very good, and the success that we've had as a firm is because of you. We hope that you recognize that this event, the luncheons like this that we do, are an appreciation for you and the great clients you are, and our enjoyment in working with you. So with that, we'll end this. We hope you enjoyed the meal and Jack's presentation, and we hope that you'll stay and ask questions for a few minutes of Jack or of any of us that are here. And once again, thank you, and we appreciate you.
Visit a palace and dine with a king. We're gonna start living. You just wait and see.